This Week in Nuclear, episode number 72 for July 8th, 2009.
All weather decks are secured due to high winds.
This is John Wheeler coming to you live from the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier USS John C. Stennis. We're somewhere off the coast of California, steaming north to the ship's home port in Bremerton, Washington. It's a pretty nasty day outside. The Pacific Ocean is cold and a dark blue with chop, white caps, and sea spray reaching up from below to sting your face. The wind on the flight deck is a chilly 58 knots, and the seas are 6 to 8 feet. But inside the ship, there's just a gentle rocking motion. Although it's a bit on the cool side, most everyone is wearing sweaters or light jackets, although it's the middle of summer. I had an opportunity to chat with the ship's captain yesterday, and I was reminded of the unique and impressive club to which he belongs. To be the commanding officer of a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, an officer must have first have been a distinguished naval aviator, a pilot with thousands of hours of flight time and hundreds of carrier landings. Then, at the rank of captain, they're sent to nuclear power school, where they qualify as engineering officers of the watch, along with all the other Navy nukes just out of college. As a result, carrier COs are both aviators and nukes, a combination that puts them in a very exclusive fraternity. I also had lunch with the ship's medical officer, a former Navy nuke who, after his first tour of duty, decided to attend medical school, where he did residencies in flight medicine and family practice. As a result, he's a nuke, a flight surgeon, and a family practice physician, the perfect combination for the head physician aboard a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Today we toured his medical and dental facilities, where he manages a staff of physicians, medical corpsmen, dentists, nurses, and other staff, a virtual floating hospital capable of meeting the routine and emergency care needs of more than 6,000 people aboard the Stennis and several hundred more in other ships assigned to the carrier group. This is a floating city of 6,000 that never sleeps. At all hours of the day or night, the ship is alive with activity. From the bridge where they guide the ship through the water to the bakery where they create delicious pastries, and they bake literally hundreds of loaves of bread every night. Sailors work around the clock to keep the ship safe, clean, on mission, and very well fed. And except for the forklifts and other mobile lifting equipment, all of the energy used aboard this ship comes from two nuclear reactors operating just a few feet below where I sit. On my flight to San Diego, where I joined the Stennis, I just finished reading the second chapter in the story of the Adams Atomic Engine. If you've listened to this show before, you'll know that I'm an engineer, a manager, and a nuclear reactor operator, and I've spent most of the last 25 years working on or around the kinds of nuclear energy facilities that have dominated land-based commercial and sea-based naval nuclear power for the last 50 years. I'm referring to what we call light water reactors, because they use water as a coolant and to slow down or moderate the neutrons to make them more readily absorbed by the fuel. In these energy facilities, fuel atoms fission or split apart, which releases fast-moving particles. These particles bounce off nearby atoms and molecules, creating friction. As the fuel and the surrounding material heats up from this friction, the heat is picked up by ordinary water as it passes through the reactor. This hot water is used to create steam, either in the space above the fuel or in big tanks called steam generators. Then the steam is blown through turbine blades to make a turbine spin, and the turbine is attached to an electrical generator that makes electricity by spinning coils through a magnetic field. This design was the natural evolution for power plant designers 60 years ago. Nuclear energy was new on the scene then, but they already had decades of experience with steam turbine power plants fueled by coal, oil, and gas boilers. When they set out to harness nuclear fission to make electricity, they were able to take existing steam plant designs and replace the boilers with reactors. This reduced the number of uncertainties because the only new technology was a nuclear reactor itself. Rod Adams points out in his story that the light water reactor was a logical evolution of existing power plants' design during a period where time was of essence and expertise in the new technology was limited. As I thought about the origin of light water reactor designs, I realized that I had experienced a very similar evolution in my personal education and experience. First, I learned how to operate oil-fired steamships, and then later moved on to learn what it meant to replace boilers with nuclear reactors. That was an exciting time for me because I got to experience firsthand the benefits of nuclear energy. I'll never forget my first trip across the Atlantic as an engine cadet aboard the container ship SS Edward Rutledge, when I learned that we were burning 2 barrels of oil per mile. One morning, 2 or 3 weeks into the voyage, the chief engineer, Thomas Taylor, who was from Terre Haute, Indiana, looked over his steaming cup of black coffee and said in an unexcited voice, "Well, John, we just burned $1 million in fuel." I almost fell out of my chair. In 1981, $1 million was almost an unimaginable amount of money to a 21-year-old middle-class kid. Also from Indiana, by the way. The type of oil burned by steamships is called Bunker C, one of the lowest grades of refined petroleum. It's thick and sticky, and it has to be heated up with steam before it can be sprayed into the boiler where it's burned. Sometimes other fuels are used. On the SS Arco Juno, a supertanker I worked on that brought Alaskan oil to the U.S. West Coast, we had to switch from Bunker C to low sulfur oil whenever we traveled in and out of Long Beach Harbor. We had to store that low sulfur oil in specially heated tanks because it was like tar and would not pump at room temperature. Fuel oil and hot steam pipes in a power plant are a dangerous combination. Fuel oil that comes into contact with the steam pipes can easily ignite, and there were stories galore of major fires and gruesome, painful injuries and deaths. I also learned how hard we had to work to prevent even a drop of fuel oil from leaking or being spilled into the sea because of the impact to the environment and huge Coast Guard lines. Fuel oil spills are relatively easy to trace back to the guilty ship because Bunker C would cling to the hull of the ship and leave a trail of sheen on the water for miles. So later, when I studied nuclear engineering and learned to operate nuclear power plants, it seemed almost miraculous how energy could come from such a small package, and how clean and safe nuclear power was compared to oil. With nuclear energy, there's no need for routine refueling, no hazard for oil fires, no concern for oil spills, and no air pollution. The switch from oil to nuclear was a logical and natural evolution to a cleaner, safer, more compact energy source. Chief Taylor, who was in his 60s at the time, had been through a very similar transition during his career. He had started as a skinny 16-year-old kid shoveling coal into the furnace of a Great Lakes steamer. During World War II, his father had traveled with young Tom the 200 miles or so from Terre Haute north to Gary, Indiana on Lake Michigan to sign his son on as a coal tender, a job that exempted him from the war draft. The chief chuckled when he told me this part of the story, when his new boss, the boiler room fireman, saw Tom. The fireman cursed, "God damn it, they're sending me babies," and he threw his hat on the floor in frustration and stomped on it. Well, Chief Taylor obviously proved himself and eventually worked his way all the way up through the ranks from coal tender to chief engineer. And during that time, his ships switched from coal to oil. He shared with me the same wonder that I felt later about the switch to nuclear because compared to coal, oil was so clean, easy to handle, and far less hazardous. It's funny now that I think about it, the chief once told me to, quote, "stay away from that nuclear stuff because, in his opinion, it was too dangerous." He never had the opportunity to learn about nuclear power and was relying on myths and rumors perpetuated by the opponents of nuclear energy. I learned a great many things from Chief Taylor, and we kept in touch for several years. But that was one piece of advice I decided to ignore as I learned more about the benefits of nuclear energy. In the years since then, commercial ship propulsion has continued to evolve from steam turbines to large diesel engines or gas turbines. Steam plants are complex machines with miles of cable, thick steel pressure vessels, and pipes that must withstand thousands of pounds per square inch of internal pressure. There are also thermodynamic limitations on how efficient steam turbine plants can be, even under ideal conditions. Diesel engines and gas turbines cost less to operate because the engines themselves cost less, they're simpler to maintain and operate, require fewer people, and burn fuel more efficiently. It was only a matter of time before diesel engines and gas turbines replaced steam turbines for commercial and military ship propulsion. This all brings me back to my original point. Water-cooled reactors are wonderful machines that will continue to serve us for decades to come. But just as steamships switched from coal to oil, and then from steam turbines to diesel engines and gas turbines, the time has come for the next generation of commercial nuclear energy facilities. The next logical step is small modular gas-cooled reactors.
Jewish services will be held in the ship's chapel at 1800. Maintain silence in the vicinity of the ship's chapel.
These new reactors will use modular construction techniques that will lower production costs, improve quality control, and enable investors to scale up their capacity more gradually. Gas-cooled reactors coupled with gas turbines will provide improved thermal efficiencies that will produce more electricity for a given size of reactor, and it will avoid the need for heavy pressure vessels. New fuel types like non-metallic ceramics and liquid thorium will make it virtually impossible for rogue nations to divert civilian fuel to weapons programs. And these new fuel designs will revolutionize the industry because they'll eliminate the risk of meltdowns. These improvements will reduce the complexity of nuclear energy facilities, and in doing so will reduce the construction costs. All these characteristics will also reduce the risk to investors and will thus increase the rate at which small reactors will be deployed. The people who oppose nuclear energy, including some of those who compete directly with nuclear energy on the marketplace, know all of this, and they're working to slow down the implementation of these advancements. There is a major fly in the ointment. Our government is standing in the way of these small reactor innovations. Our regulatory framework and licensing process are unfair and are not up to the challenge. The fee structures for approval and licensing are biased against small reactors, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has not demonstrated a willingness to devote sufficient resources to move towards evaluating these new safer designs. This is because it will require them to depart from their established technical comfort zones. Other stakeholders are also slowing innovation. For example, the timeline the Department of Energy has published for deploying Generation 4 reactors is far, far too long. They estimate that it will take 15 to 20 years to build the first demonstration plant. In reality, most of the engineering challenges have already been solved and proven in the real world. The DOE needs to take the project away from the research community and give it to the engineers with orders to build one. The first nuclear-powered submarine was designed, built, and launched just 13 years after the very first controlled nuclear chain reaction. And the first commercial nuclear plant was designed and built in a matter of months, not years, without the benefit of more than 50 years of experience in modern computer-aided design techniques. Those engineers used slide rules and hand calculations, where today's engineers and scientists have more computing power on their desks than existed in the world in 1950. We need a national commitment to move more rapidly and decisively on small, gas-cooled modular reactors with determination and leadership. We need to put aside the politics of fear and favoritism and focus on the truth inherent in real-world experience, sound science. I'm not suggesting that we throw safety to the wind. On the contrary, the potential consequences of inaction or slow action are far greater than the risk of moving forward with urgency. You may think I'm asking for too much, but if we don't demand change and demand it loudly, then this natural evolution will be too long in coming. We'll miss an opportunity to enjoy the results that we need now to eliminate air pollution and reduce reliance on fossil fuels. This change will be as natural an evolution as the switch from sail to steam, and we need leadership to get us there as quickly as possible. This is John Wheeler for This Week in Nuclear. Have a great week.